Welcome back, everybody, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. Today, we're going to talk about divorcing a high-conflict spouse, and we have the guru, the international guru of high-conflict personalities and how to deal with them. We have Bill Eddy. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks so much, Judy. I'm glad to be on with you.
And we're on location in San Diego, where his High Conflict Institute is located. And Bill's actually ready to jet off to some other country or city to teach. But here's Bill. Bill is the triple threat. Bill is a lawyer, a therapist, and a mediator, the co-founder and training director of the High Conflict Institute. Bill developed an extremely important niche in our society and certainly in divorce. He has become an international expert on managing disputes involving high conflict personalities and personality disorders. He provides training to every single human walking the face of the earth who has a relationship with anybody. So individuals, colleges, businesses, court systems, and he's great at it. He's an author of 17 books. I've read almost every one of them, and they have figured prominently in how I conduct my mediation business, Bill. I want to tell you that. And anybody I've recommended your books to will always call me back and say, changed the dynamic measurably. So thank you so much for your time.
I'm glad to be helping, and people really need this information, as you said.
Boy, don't they. Okay, so let's get started. Bill, what is a high-conflict personality?
Well, basically, it comes down to four characteristics that repeat and repeat and repeat, and anyone can observe these. First of all, and really easiest to see, is they're preoccupied with blaming other people. It isn't just, oh, by the way, I think it's somebody else's fault in this situation. It's constant. It's every situation. They take zero responsibility and hold other people responsible. The second is a lot of all or nothing thinking. And so they'll see solutions as it's my way or the highway. They're not flexible with that. They get into extreme positions. Third is often, not always, but often unmanaged emotions, where the emotions really take over. Sometimes that's very dramatic, someone running out of a room, someone starts yelling. But sometimes it isn't as dramatic, but it drives what they're doing. They plan to do something and suddenly they're upset and they're off in a whole other direction. And the fourth is extreme behavior. They have a pattern of doing things that 90% of people wouldn't do. And so it may be how they communicate or spreading rumors or domestic violence, hiding children, hiding money, doing things that they have an excuse for. But if you ignore the excuse and just look at the behavior, you go, wow, 90% of people would never do that, even if they were tired or stressed or upset. And that's often how you realize, whoa, I'm dealing with a high conflict personality. So it's a pattern of behavior that includes these four parts that repeats and repeats and repeats.
And with that, then, how many types of high conflict personalities are there?
Well, here's what's interesting is they seem to overlap with personality disorders, but not necessarily the disorder, but at least traits of these five personalities. And for people that don't know, there's 10 personality disorders identified by mental health professionals. Five of them seem prone to being high conflict. The other five avoid people, avoid conflict. You don't see them driving conflict, but they may be involved, but not as the driving force. So the five are basically narcissistic, antisocial, borderline, paranoid, and histrionic. And so when they overlap with a high conflict person, that means that their dysfunction gets focused on blame. And so if, say, they're narcissistic, so narcissists are very self-absorbed, but they also have to be superior. So they need somebody to look down on, someone to be demeaning to be pushing down, to push themselves up in their own eyes and maybe the eyes of others. So that's why a spouse can become a target of blame for them, to help in their arrogance as they say, look at her, how really ridiculous she, I would never do that. Or she always, but it's an arrogant, demeaning relationship. And that's why we see them in so many divorce situations, often high conflict ones, or in danger of being high conflict. And that's where, if you want to do amicable divorce, is learning how to manage that person. So there's narcissistic with that drive to demean the other person. Antisocial is really, in many ways, the bully personality. Their drive in life is to dominate others. They'll dominate their spouse. They'll dominate the children. And really with a lack of remorse. So these are people who are comfortable lying a lot, comfortable maybe hurting other people. We see them in some of the domestic violence cases. But they also may spread rumors, may pretend they're doing one thing. I'm going to be gone this weekend. I have an important meeting. I think the CIA wants to interview me about a project. Well, they're out having an affair this weekend, but they're making it sound like it's, oh, and I can't talk about it because, you know, secrets and secret service, those types of things. So they're really big liars. And in divorce, they are often spinning tales about the other person and making themselves look like a victim, you know. So that's one. Borderline personality disorder, that's much more commonly known nowadays. Wide mood swings, sudden and intense anger, a clinging on the one hand and then a rage on the other hand. And we see that in some domestic violence cases. But even without violence, there can be an intense emotional targeting of their spouse, targeting of the children.
Bill, do we, or have we called this bipolar disorder?
It's totally different. Bipolar disorder is a disorder where someone has mood swings over weeks and months. So they may have a manic episode for a couple weeks, they're buying a lot, meeting strangers, calling in all the talk shows, just hyper social. And then maybe 2 or 3 months of depression, they don't go out, they don't talk to anybody, they don't call their friends, people worry, are they alive? So it's this slow kind of mood swings.
Okay.
But borderline personality disorder has fast mood swings. And so within minutes, you may have a person who seems very loving and friendly and someone who's outraged. And they idealize people and then devalue them. So you get these extreme kind of roller coaster relationships. But that's the difference.
Okay.
Now, what's really interesting is there's a lot of overlap that people with borderline personality disorder, there's some research done several years ago, found that 30 to 40% of them also had bipolar disorder. And so sometimes it can be confusing. Bipolar disorder, generally treatable with medications.
Right.
Whereas all the personality disorders, there's no medication really for them. So sometimes what psychiatrists do is they give someone bipolar medications and then see if they get better. And if they have bipolar disorder, they generally will get better, but they may still display some of these borderline characteristics.
Okay.
So it's two different things.
Okay. And then there are two more, right?
Yeah. So real briefly, paranoid personality. And these are very suspicious. They think that people are whispering about them, talking behind closed doors, conspiracies. They, in divorce situations, often just assume, well, the other party's lawyer, you know, his lawyer must be talking to the mediator or talking to the judge. Those types of things. So it's They're suspicious of their spouse the entire relationship. You know, who did you have lunch with today? You know, was it a man or a woman? Are you having an affair with them? So there's this fear, and asking the kids to report on the parents' behavior. That's not unusual with this personality. Lastly is histrionic, very dramatic, emotional, you know, not real focused. In some ways, like borderline, there's intense emotions, but not so much the anger. And emotions may be fleeting. And so it's like this thing, oh my goodness, you won't believe what happened. And then this thing happened, and then this thing happened. And it's interesting, is this the only personality I know that can talk without breathing? They go from drama to drama, and then this, and then that, and then that. And you're waiting for a pause to get a word in, and it doesn't come because they just, you know, keep talking so much. Anyway, that's a brief explanation.
Those are great explanations. And one last question about that. When I got into the divorce business in 2012 as a mediator and a legal document assistant, so I filed for amicable divorces, it was all about bipolar. That's all I heard. And so that was my introduction to bipolar. But now, in the past year or two, I hear narcissism.
Yeah.
Does the change in our culture change the dominance of one of these personality types?
I think there's an interaction with the larger culture. As I said in one of my books, Don't Alienate the Kids, is there's really three cultures of blame involved. And so in the family culture, you have someone with a high conflict personality. They're always blaming somebody. Kids grow up going, oh, our neighbor's to blame. Mom's boss is to blame. Oh, now it's dad. Dad's to blame. Yeah, we know how to do that. So you have the family culture of blame. The family court process is very much a culture of blame. You know, it's all your fault. No, it's all your fault. We'll go to court and the judge will decide.
Someone wins, someone loses.
Yeah, and people build up teams. You know, you've got your lawyer on your side and you've got witnesses and this and that. But the larger worldwide culture of blame is, I think, impacting families and impacting high conflict divorces. So our larger culture through TV, movies, drama, and real life reporting, the news, world leaders start acting in very narcissistic ways. That starts coming out in society more so. So I think right now we're seeing a real increase in narcissism in our divorces, but also in the larger culture. Bipolar, just a few years ago, people are starting to see mood swings. A lot of that really was borderline mood swings, but people didn't know what they were looking for.
Right.
So mood swings in relationships. But I think all of this is influenced by kind of the high emotion media. And so bad relationships get more attention than good. So we see TV shows about bad relationships. Movies, bad relationships. I call it the Jack Nicholson syndrome, where you have these movies where Jack Nicholson is this just narcissistic, arrogant jerk at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end, he's kind of warm and cuddly.
True.
And it's amazing. And there's so many, he's got like half a dozen movies where that happens.
Yep.
And so he's very narcissistic. But what I tell people is that's not real. So you're dealing with a narcissist who's really awful to you, demeaning, et cetera. And people are tempted to wait for them to become the sweet and cuddly Jack Nicholson character. And it doesn't happen. And that's when they go, oh, it's time to get divorced. And then they realize in a divorce, it's even worse. So people need to understand the personalities and how to manage them.
Absolutely. And now we're going to move to the next piece, which is communication. And communication is how we deal with each other. We have written communication and we have oral communication. Yes, we have body language, but for the purposes of this discussion, let's do written and oral communication. It's going to be the centerpiece of our relationship with a high conflict personality and how we deal with them. You devised a method that, again, I have used and it works brilliantly. It lives by the acronym BIF. Can you please explain what this is?
Yeah. BIF stands for brief, informative, friendly, and firm. And we developed this about a dozen years ago. I think it was 2007. I remember when we started teaching this method. And it's really simple. And what really works is simple. It doesn't mean it's easy, but it's simple. So first of all, you get a hostile email. And they say, you did everything wrong. You know, you're a jerk. You're stupid. You don't know what you're doing, all that stuff. So the temptation is to respond and say, no, you did everything wrong. You're the idiot. You did this. But instead, keep it brief. So typically a BIF response may be 3 or 4 sentences. Even 2 or 3 pages of an email haranguing you, 3 or 4 sentences is usually sufficient. And it also saves you time because you're not answering every little allegation or whatever. Second is it's informative, just straight information. So it's not your opinion. It's not your defense. You don't have to defend yourself against hostile anger like people have because it's not about you. It's about that person's difficulty managing themselves. So just straight information. No opinions, emotions, defenses, arguments, straight information, something that make people think about. We want people thinking rather than reacting.
Key.
Then friendly is like a friendly, you know, greeting. Thank you for responding. Or I was pleased to read, I was pleased that you addressed this issue or my concern or whatever. Something that just puts a positive on it. Maybe end with, you know, have a good weekend or, you know, something like that. And then firm, and firm doesn't mean harsh. It means you end the conversation, especially if there's hostilities. You want to end that hostile conversation. So don't put little barbs out there like, so what do you think of that, buddy? You know, skip that. But don't leave the door open. Don't say, you know, well, how do you feel about that at the end? You don't want to open. You want to close. What we've learned with high conflict people is they don't need more self-expression. They need more self-restraint, more containment. And so that's a lot of what we're looking for, is ways to do that. And BIF does that.
Yes. And the part about being firm as well is typically somebody who has unmanaged emotions, or describing the high conflict personality, they will try again. They will send another text, another email, because they didn't get fed, right?
Yeah.
And so firm is not responding or sending the exact same thing back. Did I not read that in one of your books?
That's pretty much it. Or nowadays, what we've been suggesting is shrink it down. So if you need to, if they come back and say, but what about this? Is you can give a briefer response that says, actually, I already addressed that. I have nothing further to add. So you don't necessarily keep it the same size. So shrink it down, and I won't be responding further on this subject. They send you another one.
Don't even respond, right?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Excellent.
So it's almost like 3 steps. You do your BIF response, then you do a briefer BIF, and then you don't respond at all.
And that really takes so much weight off of the other person's shoulders, doesn't it?
Yeah. And what's interesting, I have to tell you, Judy, is we're getting feedback now from people saying, like, I'll have a lawyer say, you know, my client's been using the BIF approach for 6 months now, and the other side is starting to write back in the same way, but they don't even know what it is.
Wow.
It's like it influences the other person. And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But they start seeing, oh, that looks so much more reasonable. My thing looks awful. And I tell clients sometimes, I say, if your emails end up in court, which they do sometimes these days, which email do you want to be associated with? And so people feel proud of them, and they feel good that they didn't get down in the mud.
Yes.
And what I find is reasonable people get it pretty quickly and can start doing it, and they're relieved that they don't have to throw mud back.
Yes.
But high conflict people also can learn this method. And that's what's so good, is I teach lawyers, therapists, everyone, is teach your clients to use this approach. And so even high conflict people can get it because they look better and it's fairly simple.
Okay, now let's take a couple examples that
sure.
will come up in a high conflict situation, and maybe you can help respond. So the non-high conflict spouse, the reasonable spouse, wants to tell the other spouse that they need a divorce. How would they ask for it? This is a tough one.
Well, probably, well, there's a few different levels of how that might be. One may be in person. If it's not a dangerous relationship, it may be doing this in person may be the most reasonable and, in a way, the least escalating way to do it. Another is doing it in a counselor's office and saying, you know, we've been struggling and I've now decided I want a divorce and I respect you and I want to work with you on this and recognize what we've had, but now we're going in different directions or whatever. Certainly not blaming yourself and not blaming the other person. Is we're going in different directions.
Okay.
It's so tempting to blame a high conflict person and to just give them an intense rant, and I'm getting divorced because you. And it may all be true, but it just engages the person. If you're disengaging, you need to be emotionally calm and not drawing the person in.
From the start.
Yeah.
Lay down those ground rules.
And staying with that process. Because once you start reversing yourself or escalating, you draw them in, but you're really serious about it, then now you're in, you're out, you're in, you're out. Emotionally, they feel engaged, like you're not leaving them, when you really are. And then when it really hits home, it's harder. I also encourage steps. People to say, look, it's come to this. I think we both know it's not working. And I've decided I need to get a divorce. And I'd like us to think about what we need to do. I'd like us to meet with a mediator. And start there so that we can keep this peaceful. I respect you. I hope you respect me. And I want this to, and especially if kids are involved, to just be as peaceful as possible, or amicable, as you say.
Yes.
So don't start with everything and then go to the mediator and talk about who's going to file the petition. How are we going to deal with the paperwork so that it's not total devastation.
God, okay, that makes a lot of sense. Now, but with all of those good intentions and those good steps, here are a couple phrases that we all hear repeatedly, and maybe you can give a biff to this.
Sure.
Some of those examples will be, I'll take you for everything if you divorce me, or you'll never see the children again, followed by, you leave this house and you'll never get a penny from it. What do you think?
Yeah. So you need to be prepared for those types of comments and be able to be matter of fact about them. And so let's suppose you're getting this in writing, which you may get this
maybe
in person, maybe in writing. You may get a mixture of this. But in either case, you want to be able to respond with, you know, I understand this is a hard time. I understand this is upsetting. I've been gathering a lot of information, and I'm not concerned that either of us will be cut off from the children, and I'm not concerned about these extremes that you're mentioning. I think we'll be able to manage this, and most people do.
Wow.
Have a good weekend.
That's great. I love that.
But that's because I'm prepared.
That yeah. was beautiful, because this happens. All right, now. Again, with all the best intentions, we are litigating. And
okay.
It looks so two lawyers are hired. Brief little story. I was at one of the bar associations that I belong to for a seminar one night. We were having dinner before the seminar began, two lawyers were sitting next to one another. The one lawyer says to the other lawyer, hey, I got a great case today. And I got a call from opposing counsel. So the lawyer who was telling the story is representing the wife, opposing counsel is representing the husband.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently the husband has a lot of money and is going to cover everybody's legal bills. But opposing counsel says to her, get ready, I'm going to paper you to death. Now the lawyers are engaged in this. What's the right? So let's talk about that. So this conflict is engaging the lawyers. If the lawyers want to do right by their clients, what would they do? If they want to make money, what would they do?
Well, you're saying how would the lawyer respond? Or should they?
How do kind of like, let's take a read on the lawyers to see how they're participating in escalating the conflict.
Well, let me just say, because people have a lot of opinions about lawyers, my experience, and I came into practicing law after 12 years as a therapist, so I'm pretty astute, I think, about reading personalities. And I would say that I truly believe about 80% of lawyers are sincere, want to help their clients, and are doing what they think is best, although sometimes they may do extreme things that I think are unhelpful, but that they have sincere thinking behind it. I'd say about 20%, it really is about money, but I also think that 20% may have high conflict personalities and themselves enjoy dominating other people, enjoy demeaning other people. And so that gets mixed in, and it's such an easy profession to play out these personality traits. So when I think of, you know, society, 10% of people are high conflict, it may be in the legal profession we're looking at 20%. But 80% I don't think are. So let's say the person saying, I'm going to paper you to death, is one of those, you know, high conflict lawyers that may enjoy dominating, demeaning, etc. So let's say a reasonable lawyer, same kind of language, high conflict person, reasonable person, would say, you know, that's not necessary, and you know that the court's not going to like that. Here's what I suggest. And then talk about meeting, talk about doing a four-way conference, doing something that's reasonable, but being prepared that the other person may not want to do it in this amicable way. And the worst cases I've had, I think, had a high conflict lawyer on the other side, and they barely talked to me because they knew that the money is in paper. And if everything comes by letter, by document, by demand, you can charge for that.
Yes.
And if you solve something over the phone, wow, you just missed out on 5 or 6 hours of work. So I think partly it's reading who's the other person, who's the other lawyer, how can I deal with them? If they're reasonable, but they think they're doing the right thing because their client is a high conflict client, then, you know, you can kind of work with this reasonable person to help contain the case. If they're a high conflict lawyer, then you have to be very assertive about, you know, presenting your case, stopping things, using the court sometimes to stop actions, using the court sometimes to get things from them. Because high conflict people demand stuff, but they don't respond. Or they respond to a request with an unrelated demand.
Yes. And that's not enough. I need more. I need more.
Yeah. So there's kind of a whole set of strategies. I have a book, High Conflict People and Legal Disputes, for lawyers and judges and mediators about managing these kinds of cases. Then I have a book for parties going through this called Splitting, Protecting Yourself While Divorcing Someone with Borderline or Narcissistic Personality Disorder. So there's strategies for all of this.
Okay, good. Because if you're the reasonable spouse, so to speak, or the spouse that understands and knows what's coming ahead, how do you even manage your own attorney?
Mm-hmm. And it's so important for people to know that you're in charge of your attorney. You can hire and fire your attorney.
Yes.
But listen to your attorney and see what makes sense. So it's kind of a supervisory position, but you don't want to alienate your lawyer.
Right.
But and this is all about communication, and I think that's the most important thing between a client and the lawyer. I do a lot of consultation with individuals and with lawyers, and I get individuals saying, well, I want a lawyer that knows what you know or approaches things the way you do. And I say, there aren't many like that, and I'm not representing people anymore. I just consult. But what you really need is someone you can communicate with, because if you can communicate, then you can deal with the areas of knowledge they may not have. And most good family lawyers know what to do. They just don't necessarily know why. They don't have the psychological background
right.
like that I do.
So you're in court, and the last person you have to deal with is the judge. So you have the high conflict person and the reasonable person. How does the reasonable person get their points across through their attorneys or just to open the eyes of the judge, maybe what's going
yeah.
on?
Well, there's two key things, and these are both in that book, High Conflict People and Legal Disputes, which anybody can read, even as though it's designed for professionals. And that is first explaining to the court, who probably realizes this is a high conflict case. In a high conflict case, you have to have three theories. One is that one person said the other person's acting badly, and it's true. The second theory is it's not at all true, and the person who's saying that is a high conflict person. They're lying or just distorting unconsciously. Depends. Some people do each. Or the third possibility is both people are acting badly. And so you have to explain to the court that you have to consider all three of these theories of the high conflict case. And now let me explain why it's the first theory. In this case, it is true that the other person is acting badly, and here's how they're acting badly. And then you present three or four patterns of behavior. You keep it simple so that the judge can absorb and think about these three or four patterns. So the person is abusive to the children or something, and then give the worst examples so that you understand, is this, you know, minor stuff or major stuff? If it's, say, you're dealing with an antisocial, which is now the one you're going to see passing narcissistic in the next couple of years. We're seeing a lot more antisocial behavior in family court and perhaps society. So if they're antisocial, you need to say, and this person lies and misleads professionals. And here's some of the worst examples.
Ah, that's good.
And here's the person's emotionally insensitive to the children. And here's the worst examples. And here the person undermines the mother's parenting. And here's the worst examples of those. And that's it. You don't give 10 patterns. You give three or four. It can't be digested.
Kind
more
of following
than that.
The Biff method. Keep
exactly.
it brief. Informative.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we find that this, and then I remember when I was practicing in court and the judge would start saying, well, isn't this the case of misleading professionals? And I go, yes, he got it. He's absorbed the issue. And now he's looking at information that supports or doesn't support that theme, that pattern. And now they're looking for it. When one of the mistakes I think a lot of family lawyers do, especially in high conflict cases, is they just have a wall of words and they have declarations and this and that. And it's chronological. And it becomes the judge's eyes glaze over. You want to hit the hardest points at the beginning that structures how to look into the rest of the case.
Yes.
And so that's what I've found, is it's really about presenting information, factual information. It's not emotional arm waving, which high conflict lawyers do. It's factual information. And you repeat it and repeat it so that people get it. And that's how reasonable people prevail eventually.
You know, that's beautiful because a few weeks ago, I uploaded an episode with Judge Mark Juhas, who's at Stanley Mosque, downtown Los Angeles. And he was saying exactly the same thing. Don't give me every single part of your case. Start at the very top with the essential points. Let me wrap my head around it. And if I need more information, I will ask for it.
Right, right. Because that way, now they're looking. They have a structure to fill in. But if you don't give them a structure to fill in, they can't, it's hard to grab hold of.
That's right. And it's very hard for people to tell their story because there's so much of it.
Yes.
And you're lost in it.
Yes.
And you don't know where to go with it. And that's why sitting down with a writer, a professional who can help you delineate, structure, maybe even a mediator, just to get it down correctly, briefly, and then you've got a case to present.
Yeah. And I do a lot of consultation, and that's often what it's about, is you tell me your whole story, I've got an hour. You tell me your story for half an hour, and now let's break it into three or four themes, patterns of concerning behavior,
yeah,
and make it something that people can wrap their head around.
Absolutely great. So in the last few minutes of this episode, since this is a podcast devoted to amicable divorces,
yes,
and we are mediators in this room,
yeah,
is it possible to engage in mediation with a high conflict personality?
Yes. And I think it's always worth trying mediation first, even in high conflict cases. The thing I caution lawyers and clients about is you may also need to prepare for court while you're mediating, for a lawyer and even the client. So if you end up, it doesn't work, you're ready to go to court. So in a sense, it's a two-track approach, but the preference is always to try to do it out of court. It's going to escalate the high conflict person less if you can do it out of court. Because once they're in court, they're stuck. They can't get out of court on their own because they have to defend and make allegations and do all of that. And so it's really, you're putting them into a war zone and they're going to act like warriors, which is their instinct.
Yes.
Whereas in out-of-court opportunities, ADR, you know, mediation,
right,
collaborative negotiations, yes, etc., is you keep things calmer. And actually the professionals, the mediator, you know yourself, you can say calming statements to both people. And when they start, you know, ratcheting up, you can calm them down. So someone lets out a nasty remark and I'll say, hang on, let's stay focused on where to go from here. And the other person says, but Bill, I have to respond to that comment that she just made. And I'll say, no, you don't, because it's mediation and we're focused on the future. And she made a comment about the past and we're going to ignore that. We're going to focus on the future. So in mediation, you can kind of keep steering them back to problem solving. And if they reach an agreement in mediation, they own the agreement. It's not the judge handing it down. It's the parties that pieced it together, and they're much more likely to follow it.
So if you are the reasonable spouse in the mediation, you know that they communicate their fear that nothing will get done, especially if you have the antisocial bully as,
yeah,
your spouse, or the narcissist. You know he's going to charm you or she's going to charm you. That's what we hear a lot, right?
Yeah.
So how should the reasonable spouse get ready for and deal with their other spouse at a mediation?
A couple things that I think are important. One is to get yourself ready beforehand, is to think of an encouraging statement to remind yourself of during the mediation. You know, all we have to agree on is the final agreements. I don't have to defend myself here. It's not about me, what he says. So you've got one of these phrases or more that'll help you stay calm. I remember doing a mediation before that. It was a post-divorce mediation, and a husband had remarried and the wife hadn't, and her income changed, and so they were going to have to mediate about child support and spousal support. New wife wanted to participate in that mediation because she said, finances affects me too. And so I asked the ex-wife, it's always up to them, because sometimes I find it productive to have the other person there rather than behind the scenes undermining stuff. So she says, I'm willing to do it if you can give me some ideas for how to cope. And I said, think of a phrase to remind yourself to help you stay calm. And afterwards, she said, that was so helpful. She said, because I stayed calm. And she did. She did a good job. And it was productive because all the decision makers were in the room. Now, that's one part. Get yourself emotionally ready. The other is think of proposals and come in with proposals, because what we find is with high conflict people, they're stuck in the past. And because they're finger pointers, they want to say, you did this and you did that and you shouldn't have done this and you always did that and you never did this. And you want to just be able to focus on, well, here's my proposal, and just ignore all of that, essentially noise. And the more, and I train mediators and I train them with this approach, is just keep the focus on the future, keep moving forward. They slip into the past and say, so what do you propose? He never picked up the kids after school to take them to karate. Then what do you propose? Well, I guess that he pick up the kids after school and take them to karate on Wednesday. And it's like, okay, problem solved. We don't have to talk about the past.
You know, when you spoke at one of my association seminars one day a few years ago, when I met you for the first time in person after reading some of your books, you showed videos of how you do it, and it works. Mm-hmm. I actually started doing it. I was allowing too much time to go by listening to the conflict in front of me. And as soon as I gave that positive look to the future, it actually changed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So simple.
I should tell you that I learned that after a 9-hour mediation. After 9 hours, we said, we have to stop. And next time, let's just talk about what to do. And then within 2 hours, everything got resolved.
We learned through our own experiences.
I learned the hard way.
Don't we all? Yeah. So we have come to the conclusion of this episode, Bill. Again, I have learned once again, even though I've read your books, more by sitting and talking with you.
Great.
And I want everybody else to have the same experience. How do they get in touch with you?
Okay, well, High Conflict Institute is our organization. We have several people. We have speakers. We have consultants. We also have videos, books, articles, etc. So highconflictinstitute.com. Also, I don't know if I should tell you this, but you can get all my books on Amazon as well. I don't want to compete with myself, but that's okay. I want people to get the books.
Good.
So you can go to Amazon and just put in Bill Eddy, and there's a page pops up with the dozen or more books. I'm losing track.
17.
Okay.
I counted this
morning. Okay.
And Eddie is spelled E-D-D-Y.
Why?
And
yes.
Bill, do people still engage you as a mediator?
So I've been doing mediations up to now, but I'm actually winding that down and focusing on speaking, writing, and consulting.
Okay.
So I don't want to have people look for me as a mediator. I'm actually, as of this month, I've finished 40 years as a mediator, and I figure that's a good time to focus really on writing about this. And I am working on a new book called Mediating High Conflict Disputes.
Okay, this is perfect for mediators, for all
yes,
of us.
Yes, yes. And I've been teaching it as a seminar, but I haven't put it in a book. I've got some little articles, but this time we're going to put it in a book because it really makes even more sense to me now than 5 years ago. And I really want to let people know because it's simple.
Yes, and anybody looking at mediators for their divorce can ask, do you know of Bill Eddy? Do you know of these methods? If you do not, I would like to use you as a mediator. I'm connecting with you. Would you please read this book first?
Yeah, that's fine. I should also mention, we have on the website, highconflictinstitute.com, a video. I did a demonstration video of our methods. I did a 3-hour improv with two actors because it's hard to get, well, high conflict people won't let me videotape them. So, and reasonable people just solve things. So I wanted actors who could show the drama, the calming, because it's an up and a down, an up and a down in real life, even with high conflict people. So we did 3-hour improv mediation. I told them their incomes, their children. I wanted to see anger, tears, allegations of everything, and then manage them. So I didn't know when things would be coming, and they surprised me. They go, well, Bill, blah, blah, blah. And I go, oh, there's that topic now. Okay, well, here's how to deal with that.
Yes. No, your videos are great. I've learned from them as well.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bill. I really appreciate this.
My pleasure.
And I know all of you do as well. So this is Judy Weigel, your amicable divorce expert, concluding yet another episode with Bill Eddy of Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week.